Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Muy buenos días. Muchas gracias por estar aquí. Mi nombre es Peter Florence, and I promise you that you will understand more of what I say through my friend Isabella now than if I try to speak any more Spanish. It's a great honor to welcome the Swiss writer Peter Stamm. We're going to talk about his novels, about short stories. He's very kindly agreed to read a short part of a story in German, which you'll hear in Spanish over the headsets, and then take questions, and afterwards I hope we'll sign copies of his books afterwards. Thank you for being here, and Peter Stamm, welcome to Cartagena.
Thank you.
Can I ask, as a first question, in language terms, what does it mean to be a Swiss writer?
Well, first of all, it's wrong that Swiss always say that we are we have four languages in the country and that everybody speaks four languages. This is completely untrue. Most people speak only one language, and not even one, maybe, very well. But the more interesting thing is for German-speaking Swiss that we have when we speak, we have a very strong. It's more than a dialect. It's really another language. So we don't speak and write in the same language, and that does have an effect, I think.
The spoken language is called Schweizerdeutsch.
Yeah.
And what is it? Is it? I think you've said it's a bit like Yiddish.
Yeah, it's very close to the sounds. It sounds a little bit like Yiddish, and it's, as I said, it's more than a dialect. It's really quite a different language. But it's connected to German and but yeah, it's a complete, almost uniquely spoken language. There are some authors now who write in Swiss German, but it's not very common.
So as a young man, when you were a student, you were reading in the German tradition? Is there a Swiss literary tradition?
Well, there are some people say that this fact that we don't speak and write in the same language does do something to our language, that we write maybe a simpler German because we are not as good in German as Germans. So there is, for example, no real past tense in Swiss German. There is no future in Swiss German.
There's no future?
No. Well, we do have a future, but we don't have it in our language. I hope we have a future.
What?
So maybe that does do something to us. And my theory is that because it's not our common language, what we write, it somehow makes it almost artificial to us. It's like I've compared it to Sunday clothes, the language. It's like something you wear and you feel a bit uncomfortable because it's not what you wear every day. But that, for artists, I think that's quite good.
So what did you read? Did you read globally? Is Switzerland such a small country that it automatically looks out everywhere, or
not,
does it?
Not only Switzerland, Germany also. I think probably Germany is the country where you have the most translations in any country. I mean, I think it's about 60% of our books are translations. The Germans are extremely open-minded, and the Swiss as well, I think. It's not about the other languages in Switzerland. It's not that we have much contact with French-speaking Swiss authors, but it's really just openness to the world.
And you personally, when you were growing up, before you decided to be a writer, what literatures were you immersing yourself in? Because the reason I ask is that I want to make a very specific point about you and Proust later on. Yeah. And I'm just intrigued as to when you engaged with French literature and when you were steeped in English literature as well.
I think it was actually English first. No, the first author I read systematically was Ibsen, strangely enough.
Okay.
Plays by Ibsen. That was the first author that actually interested me as an author, and not just before I would just read books like many children. And then it was Poe, Edgar Allan Poe, through an album by Alan Parsons Project that some people might still know. And then it was Hemingway that came through language courses. We were introduced to these authors in school.
So just to be absolute, you are here being incredibly articulate in what might actually be your fourth language.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Okay, this is humiliating for a British person who struggles in his own single language. If it's fair to describe many writers as having a project, it seems to me, reading your novels and your short stories, that your project is actually very like Proust's, in that it accumulates small details, it refuses melodrama, and that you want to engage with reality in a very fluid, not gentle, but undemonstrative way. And that the way you treat life is actually a lot how life feels when you're living it, rather than when it's been rigorously driven into plot. Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I had to think about my work 2 years ago when I was writing a series of speeches I would hold at the university. And what I found out that in many of my books, it's all about retaining paradise or going back to a paradise of time not passing. I mean, it was this feeling of... maybe this feeling of happiness when you feel the moment should just, time should stop and everything would stay like that. So it's not about drama, it's not about things happening or big stories. It's more like, yeah, as you say, maybe just being.
It feels almost as if you don't like plot.
Somehow I don't, yeah. I think there is so much plot in the world. Not in the real world, but we constantly get fed with plot by advertisements, by Hollywood movies. It's so full of all those extreme stories, and sometimes you have a feeling you can just tell a book in three sentences, and that's it. Just some gay general, Russian general, turns ballet dancer and falls in love with an American spy. I mean, to me, that's not literature. It's just plot. So I'm trying to not to have plot.
So what do you start with? Do you start with an intuition, a feeling? Because just as you say you try not to have plot, it feels to me as if you're going on an exploration that you start, and I don't know what you've started your project with, but it doesn't feel like a finished thing. It feels like an examination that you've opened yourself to.
Yeah, it usually, but very often it starts with a question. I have a question that comes from anywhere. It's like in one novel, the question was, is somebody who loves me, does he have power over me, even though I don't love that other person? Or in the story from which I'm going to read an excerpt, it was a small thing that I saw in the bus. I saw a young couple in the bus and recognized myself in them, myself 30 years ago when I was having my first relationship, moving together with a woman for the first time 25 years ago. So it's usually just small events, and then I start and never know where it's going to lead.
What's the contract you have with yourself then? Because it's fascinating that you say you saw something that you recognized yourself in, rather than that you sought to mine yourself for the story.
Yeah, it usually comes from the outside, the inspiration. But then, of course, it has a lot to do with myself. But I don't even have to know what exactly the story has to do with myself. It's just something you recognize. You see thousands of stories every day, thousands of little details, and there is that one detail every 2 or 3 weeks where you think that has something to do with me. And that's the ones I try to make stories out of.
And there are little ruptures in the characters' lives which are small transformations, but are rarely revelations or turning points, are they? They keep going.
Yeah. I think that's the interesting things in life. It's not drama. It's not when somebody dies or when a war breaks out. That's an extreme, and we all know we can't really react to that. It's just we survive it in the best case. But the interesting things are the small things. What happens when something's happened? Well, that's a strange sentence. But I mean, like things, I once wondered what will happen if I don't, if I forget my kids in the daycare. What will they do? And then a story developed that had nothing to do with the basic question, but it was telling a story about the woman who's standing the children and her relation to her friend, things like that.
It's certainly in the novels the case that your men are emotionally, I think the technical term is fucked up. They're not really engagers. They're always seeking something that isn't there. And their confrontation with their own delusion is the course of the story, isn't it? Insofar as there's a story.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, you probably can tell that I'm heterosexual, so I'm more interested in women.
I have absolutely no way of telling whether you're heterosexual.
No, I'm just more interested
in references to your children.
I'm more interested in my women, female characters than in my male characters, and maybe I'm not very fair to the male characters. I don't think they are really bad persons, but it's true that maybe describing your own sex, you're more critical than describing the other, or the one you're interested in.
Well, that's interesting, because the most famous novel that's been most translated, and these books have gone around the world, 7 Years has two women who you're not kind to. I mean, Sonia is a frigid, rigid, beautiful, mm-hmm. but not fantastically attractive woman, mm. who is set against Alexander's other romantic, if I can use the word very loosely, interest, Ivona, who is ugly, dull, treated dreadfully. But it is them who carry our emotional mm. core. But did you know you were going to engage with them most when you started the book, or did that become apparent as you started to find Alexander more and more troubling?
Well, in that case, it was, I mean, it's told by the man, from the point of view of the man, so of course he's looking at the women, he's not looking at yeah. himself, that's as myself, I'm not that interested in myself, so I'm not looking at myself all the time. I knew that, I mean, you say they are not very attractive, both women, but they are both very strong, I would say. They know what they want, they go, they have their goals. So to me, they are still interesting. And Sonia has some strange attractiveness to me. Maybe we shouldn't go too deep into that.
No,
why that is the case.
Let's go there now.
Women in uniforms, or, I don't know. We all have our little secrets.
There's a lovely way in which you use architecture there to describe their emotional state, so that she presents him with this very exquisite, precise model of what their future life might be, whereas Ivona's room is a shambolic, hovel-like cave. Mm. And throughout your work, it suddenly occurs to me, as we're sitting here, that there are lots of kind of visual relevances, even more than references. It sometimes feels like you're working in a literary version of still life. Hmm. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think I actually have more painter friends than writer friends. I refuse to pretend that I can look into the heads of my characters, because yeah. I can't. We can't in real life. So somehow we have to judge people by what they do, where they live, how they arrange their stuff, what books they read. So I'm actually just looking from the outside at my characters, and of course, the way you arrange your apartment says a lot about you. When I come to an apartment, that's most of the time revealing about the person that lives there.
I'm intrigued by that first person issue. You have Alexander telling the story. We realize quite early on that I realize I don't really like him, and I'm therefore slightly, and it's brilliant, brilliant play, because then you are constantly checking his reaction to everything. But the seeing from the outside is often a way of engaging with feeling rather than psychological insight, isn't
hmm.
it?
Hmm. Yeah, but I think that my main influence was Ernest Hemingway, and when I read him, I had this feeling that he doesn't really tell you what happens in the heads of his characters, but you have the feeling you are actually there. You live these stories, because he's such good in describing situations and atmospheres, and I think that's just what I wanted to do. Maybe it's old-fashioned, but I love it. I love to create a world when I'm writing and not pretend that I know everything about my characters. I don't even know everything about myself, so how should I know anything about my characters?
What's the deal with the reader, then? How do you... Because every writer teaches you how to read them. What, if it's fair to ask you to kind of explicate it, what do you want from the reader in the way that we pay attention to your words?
Well, I think I ask quite a lot from my readers because they have to... I always say it's about 50% of the work is done by the readers, by reimagining what I have imagined. I don't describe a lot. It's really... I give 2-3 details about this room and then they have to imagine it themselves, which makes it more... I mean, which makes that everybody sees a different room, of course, but it's quite a lot of work for them.
Just, okay, will you play a game with me?
Yeah.
What 3 details would you give to this room?
I have no idea. It depends on what would happen in this room. If it's about our talk, then it's different things than if I'm in love or if I'm sad and lonely. I mean, that would, of course, change the room to the character. It might even be that the room wouldn't be important at all. If it's a very dramatic scene, then the room will just disappear because that's not, you don't think about decoration when you're splitting up with your girlfriend.
Such a great line. And tell me about your language. If I were a fluent German speaker and I was reading you, would I think this man has a spare and acute sense of pace, of style? Would I say this is heavily stylized? What would I be saying or understanding about the way you write, the words you write are put together?
Well, it's short sentences, which maybe to English people is normal, but to German is not, because many Germans make long, very long sentences. I try to use a simple vocabulary. I sometimes like technical terms. I mean, things like in one story, there is a Blattglanz spray. That's a spray you use to make plants shiny. And very technical things like that. It's really a language that tries not to draw attention to itself. Very, almost disappear while you're reading it.
That's really interesting.
So I'm always looking for the simplest word and the most simple construction. But you would probably realize that there is a very specific rhythm to it. The rhythm is extremely important. And also sounds. I mean, it is very, very worked on, but it's not showy, I think. It's not baroque.
Do you overwrite and then strip down, or do you actually...
Well, I do reread 20, 30 times, but it's just small changes. It's usually the structure is there from the beginning, from the first version. But then it's just replacing a comma with an and things like that, small things.
Because it seems to me from reading you in English that there is a very particular... And Michael Hoffman, who translates the books into English, and I think he's done all of them, hasn't
he? Yeah, it's a wonderful translator.
Has an exquisite command of rhythm and pace. Mm. And I'm wondering whether, if that's a perfect rendition of your German, do you... And I realize this is a slightly strange question, but do you construct the sentences in your head and then find that you transcribe them? Is it an oral thing for you? Is there poetry in each of those lines that you can speak and hear before you write them down?
Not before I write them down, but I do, when I reread my texts, I very often do it loud, in a loud voice, just to hear how they sound. So it is a lot about rhythm and sound, yeah. But not before, because I'm probably too dumb to remember sentences I haven't written down. So I'm writing constantly.
How do you decide whether a project is going to be a novel or a short story? Because you seem to be equally at home in both forms.
Yeah, that's actually at the very beginning. It's like when you're a painter, I mean, you have to pull up the canvas. You can't take a small canvas and then decide that you want to make a big picture. So I have to know from the very beginning whether it's a novel or a short story. And I usually even know how long the story will be, approximately, even though I don't know how it's going to end. But I have a feeling for stories that it's going to take like 10 pages or 30 pages. Or I don't know where that comes from. But.
And there is a world and there is an idea. And by very definition, a story is slightly more plotted than a novel, because it has to have some kind of thing. So it seems to me that you're almost playing the two off against each other within your own work. Is that fair?
How do you mean to play off each other?
Well, with a story, even though your natural inclination is to reject plot, to reject melodrama and denouement, or anything as sort of clunking as a storyline that follows ABC, with a story, however you conjure the world, it's got to be complete, and you don't do a last line reveal which suddenly turns the whole view and makes you look back on the story afresh. But it's got to have a kind of narrative coherence that doesn't necessarily have to flow in the big flow of a novel, because you're dealing with moments of time. So I'm just interested in your relationship to time. It seems to me sometimes that when your stories are collected together, you get a bigger picture from the accumulation of the stories. And that in itself is a different way of looking at narrative.
No, it's true. It's but still, the process is the same. I don't know when I start a story. I don't plot it before I've write it. It's actually just go forward. But I guess at some point you get a feeling for form, where you make decisions in writing that you don't know yet what they are good for when you make them. I might introduce a character and not really know what it's good for, and 20 pages later I realize that I needed this character and what it's there for. So it's all about, it's very intuitive, the work. It's all about feeling what the form should be. Even when I rewrite, I very often have a feeling for the form of a story. I feel it's too thin at a certain point, or it's too, it's just falling apart, or things like that. It's like a feeling for the form, not so much for language or plot again.
Now, you referred to the story that you're going to read from, which is in English called Sweet Dreams.
Also in German.
I'm not sure what it's called in Spanish, which is fine. What do you want us to know before you introduce it?
Well, the thing was that, the interesting, I won't read the whole story, so I might as well tell you. The interesting thing, you said I don't have a final turn of the story. With this story, I wasn't sure, so I think I have two turns. It's turned, and then, because I don't like that, to have a final turn that makes the story completely different. So I made a second one, so it turns, and then it turns again, back on its feet. When I wrote this story, I wrote to my editor, I'm writing a story about a woman who buys a corkscrew, and that's basically what it is.
So that's, it's not unlike the, Mrs. Dalloway is a story about a woman who's throwing a dinner party.
Yeah.
It's very simple. These are tiny, minute, non-dramatic parts of everyday life that somehow reveal.
And it's actually even an ugly corkscrew. It's one of, maybe you know it, Alessi, this girl that has her arms, and then when you put the arms down and the corks comes up. It's an awful thing. I got it as a present once. And I gave it away the same day, I think. Shall I read?
Yeah, and you're going to read in German. So
we can
hear what...
But just three pages, so don't be afraid. Sweet Dreams. It's probably the same in Spanish, is it? You're going to hear what it is in Spanish. Der Korkenzieher war einem Mädchen nachgebildet, das ein Kleid trug, wie Lara sie von den Kindheitsbildern ihrer Mutter kannte. Ein kurzes, pastellgrünes Sommerkleid mit Glockenfalten. Nur der rote Kragen schien nicht recht zu passen. Er müsste weiß sein, aus besticktem Tüll. Lara sah die Fotos vor sich von großen Familienfesten in einem Garten in Norditalien, Bilder voller unbekannter Menschen. An manche Namen erinnerte sie sich selbst die Mutter nicht. Das war ein Nachbar, wie hieß der doch gleich? Und das sind die Kinder von Alberto, dem Cousin meiner Mutter, Graziella, Alfina. Den Namen des Kleinen weiß ich nicht mehr. Antonio? Tonino? Die Farben waren ausgebleicht und dadurch greller geworden. Es war, als wäre die Sonne in den Bildern gefangen. Eine Kindheitssonne, hell und unerbittlich. Die Familie hatte sich danach verloren oder auseinandergelebt. Wenn Lara mit ihren Eltern nach Italien gefahren war, hatte es keine Feste mehr gegeben, nur Besuche in abgedunkelten Wohnungen bei alten Menschen, die seltsam rochen und trockene Kekse auftrugen und große Plastikflaschen ungekühlter Fanta. Der Griff, mit dem man die Schraube in den Korken drehte, bildete den Kopf des Mädchens. Sie hatte einen Pagenkopf und ein maskenhaft lächelndes Gesicht. Lara schaute auf das Preisschild. Sie hatten schon einen Korkenzieher und tranken ohnehin fast nie Wein. Sie zögerte lange, die Verkäuferin schaute schon zu ihr herüber, da gab sie sich einen Ruck und ging zur Kasse. »Ist es ein Geschenk?«, fragte die Verkäuferin, machte das Preisschild ab und klebte es sich auf den Handrücken. »Nein«, Lara schüttelte den Kopf, »ich nehme ihn gleich so mit.« Sie schaute auf die Uhr, der Bus fuhr erst in einer halben Stunde. Lara arbeitete bei der Raiffeisenkasse und hatte früher Feierabend als Simon, aber sie zog es vor, auf ihn zu warten und mit ihm nach Hause zu fahren. Normalerweise saß sie im Unterstand, rauchte eine Zigarette und blätterte in einer Gratiszeitung. Plötzlich merkte sie, wie jemand vor ihr stand. Sie schaute hoch und sah Simon lächelnd vor sich stehen. Sie stand auf und küsste ihn auf den Mund und er machte eine Bemerkung über ihr Laster, manchmal scherzhaft, manchmal ernst. Aber in den letzten Tagen war es so kalt gewesen, dass sie auf ihre geliebte Feierabendzigarette verzichtet hatte und sofort in den Bus gestiegen war, der meist schon da stand, wenn sie zum Bahnhof kam. Simon war Verkäufer in einem Hi-Fi-Geschäft. Nachdem der Laden schloss, musste er aufräumen und wenn der Chef nicht da war, die Kasse machen. Die Busfahrer kannten ihn und warteten, wenn sie ihn an der Ecke auftauchen sahen. »Ich musste noch die Kasse machen«, sagte er atemlos, ließ sich auf den Sitz fallen und küsste Lara auf den Mund. »Hast du wieder geraucht?« Sie hatte sich ganz hinten hingesetzt. Die Nische mit den drei Sitzen nebeneinander war ihr Platz. Hier war nicht viel Licht und der Lärm des Motors verschluckte ihr Geflüster. Lara hatte den Mantel nicht ausgezogen, aber sie spürte Simons Schulter an ihrer. Er erzählte von seinem Tag, von schwierigen Kunden und neuen Geräten und von einem Streit mit dem Chef. Lara liebte diese Fahrten mit ihm, besonders im Winter, wenn es draußen schon dunkel war. Eine halbe Stunde über den Seerücken, durch kleine Dörfer, vorbei an Wiesen mit Apfelbäumen und über Ackerland. Im Radio lief eine Country-Sendung. Das war Sweet Dreams, sagte die Moderatorin von Reba McEntire, der die heutige Sendung gewidmet ist. Lara küsste Simon und legte ihren Kopf auf seine Schulter. Ja, yeah, that's enough, I guess.
Sounds beautiful.
It's actually, in this story there is the longest love scene I've ever written. There is a sex scene even, of one page, that's really long for my...
Tell me, and this is, I realize the scope of this question is ridiculous, but it needs to be asked. Why do you write? Because there's art that secures us and there's art that destabilizes us. What are you trying to do?
I think my favorite answer to this question is the one of Friedrich Dürrenmatt, great Swiss playwright. He said, I'm writing for professional reasons. I think that's a very smart answer. It's true. I mean, I it's a big pleasure to write to me. I mean, it's not about making money or being famous or whatever. It's really, at the beginning there was pleasure. There was just the joy of creating a world that's maybe more secure than the real world. And that's what I said about regaining paradise. It's all about creating a world that you can control. I'm not living in Colombia. I know that here it must be even much more urgent to create such a world where you can control things and you're not in danger and nothing can happen to you. But even for Swiss people, there is a need to create such worlds.
You've twice, just this morning, been kind of very winningly self-deprecating about your own personal status. But you've introduced yourself more into the act of writing than most writers might. I was intrigued by that. How much of this is writing in order to explore things that you are yourself troubled by?
Maybe not troubled by, interested in. There is an interesting case. My American publisher Judith Gurevich with the other press. She used to publish uniquely psychological books about Lacan psychotherapy. And I think my book was the first one she published that wasn't theoretical nonfiction. And she said at some point that she realized that there is much more truth in literature than in all those psychological nonfiction books. And I mean, I did study some psychology for a while, and it's the same feeling that I have. It's really a way of understanding the world and of finding out things about people. And that's important. But also beauty. I mean, it's all about beauty, too. It's just beautiful to read and to write, isn't it?
Yes. Profound.
Sometimes, not profound. Always.
Is it true you were an accountant?
Yeah.
How much did that affect the rest of you? Did it make you, and I know this is a cliche, but were you so bored with accountancy that you realized that life was made up with more than ledgers and numbers and...
No, actually, the reason was I was fed up with school, so I didn't want to go to school anymore, and mainly because of a sports teacher. It's ridiculous now, but at 16, it's important what the sports teacher does with you. So, I mean, he didn't do something with me, but it was just a sadist. So I wanted to get out of school.
So you say he was a sadist?
Yeah. Not a bad sadist, but I just was fed up with school.
Like a Doris Lessing novel, The Good Sadist.
So I had to do something, and as my father and my mother were both bookkeepers, and not narrow-minded bookkeepers, they were extremely interested in arts and literature and everything. So I had a good image of this profession, and it was fun, actually. Because in bookkeeping, it's always like literature. If you look at the bookkeeping, everything is mirrored in your bookkeeping. Whatever you do, it costs money. I mean, if you have a lover, you will buy flowers that cost money. I mean, everything is somehow part of it. It would be great to write a bookkeeping once.
I love the idea of double entry literature.
Yeah, why not? Imagine a book that would just contain bookkeeping of a person. Might work. I tried it. Copyright, it's mine.
Yeah, okay. I'm just intrigued by the way you just touch little details, like the corkscrew, is such a sweet thing to turn on. And I'm just intrigued as to how those things, of all the things that you pick, fall into place. It's the mystery that those of us who are readers want to know, that alchemy that writers perform. Mm. You have a feeling about something, you have an intuition about some tiny detail, which becomes the way you try to explore someone's life. Mm. And I guess that process of art, the making of art, is so unlike the process of accountancy that I just wonder what the switch in you was. That
yeah, but I just thought about a little booklet I found from my grandfather. He was born 1903, and he was from a very poor family, and he couldn't study because they didn't have money to send him to school, so he became a gardener. And I found a little booklet he had during his apprenticeship as a gardener, and he would note all the... He didn't have time to write a lot, but he wrote all the expenses he had, how much money he got from this and that, Miss Frau Doktor or something, who gave him 50 cents for bringing her flowers, and then you saw that he spent quite a lot of money how do you call it? Timbre, to send mail, what you put on a letter.
Stamps.
Oh my God! So he spent a lot of money for stamps, and that was so touching that this young fellow who was at some castle being a gardener would obviously send letters to all kinds of people. I don't know what he wrote, but it was very touching to see that in a tiny, tiny little writing. So it's, I don't know, I mean, there are so many details, and it's difficult to find the ones that are interesting, because you...
Do you start some and then just have to discard them, because they don't play out the way you thought they might?
Yeah, it works. Usually it's when characters don't interest me anymore, and you can't write about a person that you're not interested in. So it happened a few times that, or maybe just people just didn't do anything anymore. My characters just stopped doing things, they would just go around and not...
This is another one of those reader-writer things. When you say characters just stop doing things. Mm-hmm. And you hear writers say, oh, the characters took on lives of their own. Well, clearly they didn't. I mean, they're inside your imagination. So what is that for you? What does that mean when you say they stop doing things?
Yeah, it sounds a bit mythic, but it's actually, I think we all do that. I mean, if you're 20 years old and you're in love with that girl, and then you imagine her, and then you think, what would she do if, oh, how would it be to go for a holiday with her? And then you imagine her, and even then you feel that would be her and that wouldn't be her. So you can force her in your fantasies to do things that she wouldn't do, but you feel if that is her or if that is you. And it's more like that, I think. So when I say they don't do anything, of course it means that I don't know what I should let them do, but there is a certain aliveness when you're writing.
Okay. Listen, thank you very much indeed for this part of this session. It's absolutely your turn to ask questions. I think we have roving microphones, which tend to work best if you hold them 2 or 3 inches in front of your mouth. If anybody would like to ask a question, do please put your hand up and we'll try and reach you. There's a question over here, and I don't know where the nearest microphone is. Are you going to ask in Spanish or English?
Oh, okay. Oh, great, so we don't need that.
We've got headsets if you would like to speak in Spanish. Just... no, it's above you. Sorry, just above you, there. And then we'll come back to you.
Hi. What is the reason you emphasize in your books the control of life, solitude, fear, lose situation, you lose people, you lose work, or you lose, and you failure? Why not say happiness, success, strength?
Well, first of all, that's my favorite thing by Flaubert, who said, "Le bonheur se raconte mal." Happiness is hard to tell. I mean, it's happiness is something that is there or is not there, but it's not action. Bad luck is action. Things change when you're on. If you're happy, there is no reason to change anything. So that's not interesting for writers. If you're unhappy, you try to change the situation. And then also, I think there is so much happiness in advertisement, in films. I'm so fed up with all those beautiful people loving each other and playing on the beach. It's like an avalanche of happiness that buries us. So sometimes, and we all know that that's not the truth. So we all have to deal with difficult things, with being lonely, with being left, with losing people. And I think somehow literature can help us to, just by telling you, you're not the first person who lost someone who has been unhappy, and that's somehow like a good friend that tells you it's going to be all right. So, yeah.
Question down here.
Okay. Hello.
Spanish or English?
English.
Oh, great.
So this is related a bit to the first question, but I read a couple of short stories, and it's kind of hard to find your writing here in Colombia. So I'm not very aware of biographical data. But I had the feeling that there was an influence of Austrian writers. I had the feeling. I'm not very aware. I want to know if there's Peter Handke, maybe Jelinek, influence on your writing, because there's it's almost like it's calm, the environment is pretty calm, it's pretty laid back, but I felt that there was horror underneath the surface. Mm-hmm. And that seemed very close to Austrian writers, even Austrian filmmakers, and you're writing German, so
yeah,
I would like to know if there's...
Jelinek wasn't an influence, but Handke was, yeah, that's true. Okay. The early work of Handke, what he's doing now to me is a bit... No, but the early works are certainly an influence. Yeah, I love them. He's a great, great author.
It's kind of visible. I mean, it's more you feel it. You say there's something in here. Maybe that is just an intuition.
I didn't get that second question.
You feel the influence on the writing, on your writing.
Yeah,
you feel it.
I think. It's hard to tell what influences, but at least I've read him and I've liked him, so he must be an influence, I guess.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think literature should always have something below the surface.
Yeah, like that's the Hemingway the thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Who else would like to ask a question? Yeah, just behind you there.
Hi. So, if you think that you know, we fall in love with our ideas of people and your characters take on lives of their own, do you think everyone then there's an element of creation of writing to everyone's reality?
Could you just ask the last bit again?
So do you think there's an element of creation, of writing to everyone's sort of conception of the world and of reality? If you think that you fall in love with your ideas of people and, you know, characters take on lives of their own, so then everyone has to have some sort of creative...
Yeah, I think that's what we constantly do. And that's one of the themes in all of my books, that we constantly make images of the world. I mean, that's not new. That's the Greeks knew that, the old Greeks, the very old Greeks. But that's one of my themes, that we constantly make images of the world, of other people, and that these images influence us. Maybe the writer is just a specialist in making images, and at least as a writer, even though I make images, I try to make true images and not two fails images. But even each image is somehow not the truth. So there's a constant, yeah.
There's also, throughout the books actually, this question of visibility and authenticity. You know, are the characters who are perceived by the teller, in Seven Years Alexander's case, how are they taking on their own lives? How are we seeing them? And to what degree can our relationship develop with them beyond the relationship that the narrator has with them, which I think is really intriguing, because when they take on their own lives, they obviously take on our lives as well. Is that?
Yeah.
We've got time for two more questions, which I will happily ask, unless you would like to. Yeah. Sorry, the microphone's gone to the back and it's just coming to reach you now.
Well, not a very serious question. Would you be, let's say, upset or a little bit taken aback if someone would define your way of writing as feminine?
As feminine?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have a problem with that. I mean, it's... I remember when I was studying psychology, I hated C.G. Jung, the Swiss psychologist, because he, whenever a man did something he didn't like, he just said that's his feminine part, and whenever a woman would do something brave, then he would say that's her male part. I just don't think that we are so different. So I'm who I am, and if you feel that's feminine, yeah, why not? I don't feel feminine. I don't think so. I mean, I once met Maarten et Hart, a Dutch author who used to wear women's clothes and go to town. He was not a transvestite, but he just liked to wear women's clothes. I'm not doing that. and I'm unshaved, so I don't feel that I'm very feminine, but maybe my writing is. Yeah, why not?
sorry. A question.
Can you imagine me in women's clothes? Not really.
Well, before there's a kind of outrage of it's not about the clothing, Peter, there's an interesting thing. You know, for many years throughout the 20th century, many women writers wrote about the everyday details of everyday life, mm-hmm. without kind of big dramatic plots and stuff, without that macho, mm-hmm. willy-waving boy thing, the exact opposite of Hemingway. And certainly in the English tradition, they did. And then, you know, a couple of guys start doing it in 2000, and everybody says, they're so sensitive! They're in touch with their feminine side. I think, no, they're not. They're just writing the same kind of attentive domestic drama. And it was fascinating that you said that Ibsen was the first writer that you engaged with, who is the most absolutely attentive to the catastrophes of everyday life. Mm. You know, those tiny domestic things that just break people. Mm. That tragedy doesn't have to be Greek in scale. Yeah, it doesn't have to. You don't have to have 12 people dead on the end of Act 5. You can just have somebody's quiet, hopeless disappointment. Mm. And is that sort of what you were referring?
Mm.
Never mind. But in that sense, there is a connection with a female writing tradition of the 20th century.
Yeah. And it's true that
all great writers do that. I mean, Shakespeare does it. You know, Goethe does. The tiny things are the things that break you.
Yeah, and I have to admit that even in school, I never liked this boy thing. I mean, I don't like football. I don't like being in groups of men. I always like mixed groups or just being with women. It's just more interesting. I don't like this we guys go hunting or whatever.
Do you know,
it's just not, no, it's...
Welcome to Colombia. There's something about the accent as well. I would say, lie back, Mr. Stamm, and tell me about the sadists in the gym room. There's a question here.
Thank you. I'd just like to know what you would say. What is being Swiss? What does it mean to be Swiss?
Well, it's a difficult question. Maybe I can tell you what it means to be a Swiss author.
That wasn't the question.
No, I think the interesting thing, first of all, you could think it's awful for a writer to be Swiss because nothing happens in Switzerland. Not much happens. I mean, it's mostly technical things that happen. So if you're a Colombian writer, there are so many things to tell. There is so much you have to... I mean, what your Colombian writers do, I mean, wonderfully. I know quite a few of them, and they do a great job in telling the story about what has happened. In Switzerland, nothing has happened since about 500 years. But then again, that's also an advantage because then there is the big questions that come back. What is this all about? What is life? Why are we here? That's questions you don't ask yourself in a war, because in a war you have just nothing to do, just to survive. So in Switzerland, maybe we actually deal with the big questions because the small ones are solved with money. And So it's quite nice, and except from, I mean, not all Swiss people are rich and bankers, so it's actually quite a nice land to live in. A bit like Colombia, there is lots of nature and lots of different landscapes. I love to live in Switzerland because it's so easy. You just go out and you're in... I don't like hunting, I said, but I like going to the forests and swimming in lakes and doing things like that.
So, the other thing, of course, about being a Swiss writer is that you pay slightly less tax than the Colombian writers. But for Switzerland, for European people, Switzerland is the country we all go to kill ourselves. Yeah, it's the country
right.
I'm serious. It's the country with the most relaxed euthanasia laws. You going to Switzerland has become synonymous for wanting to put an end to my suffering.
I think Belgium is even worse, or better, whatever your position is on that subject.
Yeah, I don't want to.
Let's not go into that.
But again, the point is, when you say, what is it to be Swiss? There is something about perceived neutrality. There is something about the fact that you are at literally the summit of all these huge, raging, overdramatic European superpowers, which for the last 1,000 years have, you know, steadily risen and fallen and corrupted themselves and fallen apart. And actually, Switzerland's very stability maybe means... I mean, is it ridiculous to say that just is part of your rejection of melodrama? Yeah, I'm Swiss. I don't want to do...
Maybe, yeah. But one shouldn't forget that. I mean, we were an extremely poor country for the longest time of our history. It's not that we have been rich all our lives. It's really... My grandmother still had... lived through a famine in Switzerland. So it's not that we always were rich. But there is maybe this stability and also this don't touch, I mean, leave me alone and I'm doing my thing and you do your thing. That's very Swiss, maybe.
Interestingly, none of your books or stories are necessarily set in Switzerland? I mean, there is no chocolate in any of his work. No clock.
Well, more and more, actually. The last two novels are set in Switzerland.
They're not yet translated. I mean, then it's not...
It's not about Switzerland. No.
They could be anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. We've got time for one last question. Who would like to ask it? Is there anybody waving that I can't see? Oh, yes, sir.
All right. Bueno, creo que soy la única persona que habla en español aquí en este recinto. Escuchando a Peter y a usted sobre Suiza, sin embargo, la versión que yo tengo de Suiza a través de su literatura, por ejemplo, a través de Rami, que tuvo tanta influencia en Colombia. ¿Por qué? Porque la Muerte sube al pavo, que es una gran novela, era la radiografía de los campesinos colombianos. El miedo, la intolerancia, la fiebre, las vacas, etc. No sé si el señor la conoce. Luego, el mundo, para venir más acá, de Dürrenmatt. Es un mundo muy cruel y muy terrible. La visita de la vieja dama, Justicia, que la llevó al cine, Martin Ritt, en una gran película. El diálogo del escritor con el asesino que va a matarlo. Ahí hay una implicación sobre ese mundo aparentemente simple, sencillo, donde todos cantan a el bass y donde todos son Heidi. Entonces, hay también, cuando uno lee la novela de Max Frisch o las novelas de Max Frisch, se encuentra también con esa especie de metafísica del horror, del ser cotidiano, etcétera, que Peter baja a la realidad global, a los que ya no tienen plaza, a los que son turistas del mundo. ¿Qué pasa entonces, Peter, para que ese pequeño paraíso donde todos cantan los sea descrito por estos autores como un verdadero infierno?
Not hell, I would say. But as I said, even when there is no war and when there is enough money and streets are well and there is electricity and water and even then, I mean, there are some basic questions that stay. That's that we are going to die. Just to imagine, in 50 years, nobody of us in here will be alive. Well, maybe, no, sorry, there are some young people. But, say 100 years, we'll all be dead. We have to deal with that. There is unhappy love in Switzerland as well as everywhere. There is, all kinds of things. Even when you have a perfect outside life, there is reasons for unhappiness. It's certainly not hell. It's not true. But I don't have the feeling that Colombians are unhappier than Swiss people. There are research works about how money, what money has to do with happiness, and I think it's up to $10,000 where your happiness actually rises with your income, but after $10,000 it doesn't make a difference anymore. So that's why writers are usually as happy as normal people, because even though we don't make much money, that's not the point.
You can massively increase Peter Stamm's level of happiness by buying his book.
There are not many left, actually.
And if you're very lucky, he will sign it for you. Peter Stamm, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed.